Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Ford was born in Jackson, Mississippi. He's published 8 novels and 4 collections of short stories, including Independence Day, The Sports Writer, The Lay of the Land, and New York Times bestseller, Canada, which was a finalist for the High Plains Book Award for Fiction.
Independence Day was awarded both the Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. His work has been translated into 28 languages. Richard Ford lives in Maine and Montana with his wife, Christina.
Well, Richard, it's so lovely to have you in the studio today. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure not to just get to hear it, but to actually get to do it.
We've got a lot to talk about because, your short story, Wildlife, was recently made into a feature film by Paul Dano, and it showed here in Billings. It must have felt maybe a little strange to see your work on the screen, or I guess how did that feel for you in that moment watching it at Art House when it screened?
It felt strange in a kind of unimportant way.
Okay.
In the sense that the pictures that I had in my brain from having written Wildlife 30 years ago were not precisely the same pictures that Paul put on the screen. But that's really superficial, and particularly so because I told him in the one meeting that we had before he started really developing the project, I said, just leave my book behind. Mm. Take whatever bits of my book that you want and use them to make a really good film. And I was expecting him to have done that. Corby and I talked a little bit about it's being set in Great Falls.
And it drove me nuts when you said it didn't matter where it was.
It didn't matter to me, partly because I thought he would do that, also partly because they paid me. And when they paid me handsomely, then that gave them, as far as I was concerned, the privilege to do whatever wanted. And it's also true that when I set things in Great Falls, as I have set lots of things in Great Falls, it's not really Great Falls. It's a made-up Great Falls. I mostly just appropriate the name. I remember one time when I had published a story that was ostensibly set in Great Falls in the New Yorker, and the New Yorker fact checker called me up and said, you said, and I'm going to make these addresses up, you said that the YWCA in Great Falls is at 713 2nd Avenue North. It's actually in 1415 10th Avenue Southwest. And she said, would you please just reconcile this? Would you change in your story so that it's the right address? And I said, no, I said, because the right address has too many syllables in it. So that's really what I care about. I care about how the sentence looks on the page, and I care about how many syllables the name has in it. And I care very little about the actual geographic authenticity, other than if you're going to write about, if you're going to set a story in Billings, you're not going to have the Missouri River running through Billings. It's just certain fundamental things you want to get right.
Well, and geography was important in Wildlife in some capacities because of its proximity to these fires and that storyline at the time. Right. And that, too, was inspired by what you had seen and experienced in Montana.
It's true. I was living in the Rattlesnake and far up the Rattlesnake in Missoula. And at that point on Rattlesnake Creek, I looked off my deck and I looked across the drainage there, and the other side of the drainage was on fire. And I thought, well, if the wind shifts a little bit, I'm toast over here, and my house and my dogs and my wife and me and all of us were gone. And I just thought, as I guess a novelist would, I got to write about this.
So, Richard, it's interesting when you talk about the characters in your story and what you might have imagined them being or looking like. I very much associated that story with the landscape of Great Falls. There's a certain flatness to it, and the mountains are in a distance. And then in the movie, which was filmed in Livingston, you see these big, beautiful mountains right there. And that is what confused me a little bit about the story.
I understand that. I mean, it would, being a Montana native, it would make more difference to you than to me, who is a Mississippi native. For me, landscape is inert.
That is so funny when you say that, because it's just heresy among every MFA program across the country.
Well, they need to get their heads on straight about that, because if you have that kind of fidelity to pictorial landscape in the romantic, if you will, sentimental aspects of landscape, you won't be able to rig around your sentences the way you need to change things as the rigors of writing a story cause you to change things. If you say, no, I can't change that, it has to be that way. Nothing has to be anyway. There's a wonderful line of Northrop Frye's, and Frye says that literature is a disinterested use of language. You must have nothing riding on the outcome. And for me, to have something riding on the outcome means that Great Falls has to be there on the Eastern Front. It has to be there at the edge of the place.
I wanted to come back to that idea of filming in Livingston. It was so exciting to see those vistas and those views, and also to see the way that they had set it squarely in the 60s, how these old vehicles were in the film, how they brought in the old bus lines, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, you hope that what is most important in a story, a movie, or a little novel that I would write is what the principals do.
In that sense, the time frame, I think, is very important. I see the woman who I thought did a fabulous job, the
Carrie
actress.
Mulligan.
Was just fabulous in that you don't like her, you're concerned about her.
Oh, I liked her.
In some way, you understand her place in time and her difficulty with her marriage, but also she has a freedom that is a little surprising that she acts upon that I think speaks to the 1960s.
Carrie really carried that film, too. Like you said, Richard, with the character-based example, this woman carried throughout the storyline. Like, it could have been set anywhere.
I will have to give Paul Dano whether credit or responsibility. You choose. I think in my novel, I was a little more forbearing than he was to ascribe a kind of psychic motivation for what Jeanette, played by Carey Mulligan, does in the story. I think Paul sort of definitely pushed the button for her being a little tired of her marriage, a little bit at sea in her marriage, things not going in the direction she wanted them to go, and there she is kind of strapped with a kid, and suddenly he leaves, and her husband leaves and goes to the forest fire, and it ignites, to make a bad pun, it ignites a certain fire in her. Mm-hmm. I think in my novel it doesn't work that way. And for that reason, I think maybe his film's a little bit better than my book.
You
a
can say
muted.
That. We can't say that, right?
No, I think
you're being very modest.
Well, it behooves a novelist to be modest, I have to tell you, because you're facing your own inadequacies every day.
So literature and film are really different animals, and I very much appreciated you saying that here's my story, and I'm giving you to the film director, and it becomes his story.
That's
so
right.
He takes it. Is this the first piece that you've had made into a film? Or I imagine there are several screenplays that have been done from your work.
There have been. This is the second one that's gotten produced. I wrote a film which we filmed actually in Broadview and in Billings in 1989. It's called Bright Angel, and it's made from two stories in a book of stories I wrote called Rock Springs. And I had Sam Shepard and Valerie Perrine and Dermot Mulroney and Lily Taylor and Burt Young. Had a really great cast. And I just, in fact, was involved in its being rediscovered earlier in the year. So that was the second. This book, Wildlife, is the second. The first I wrote myself, which I would like never to do again. Thank you very much.
Not a fan of the screenwriting.
Well, I'm just not very good at it.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, I'm a fan of it, but I'm just not. It's just not my lick. You know, I had my own stories, and I had to conjoin two stories and to make one story, and I think I did it rather inexpertly. And having seen the film now this summer in New York, I thought, well, it's a little better than I remember, but not very much. I didn't think that I did as good a job as I should. I used to work at Paramount. I have no excuse for this.
So we are forgiving you for not being a good screenwriter because, in fact, Richard, you are a master of two other genres, the novel and the short story. And I'm always interested in the decision-making about how you decide this has potential for a novel or this really is a short story or a short story collection.
Well, there's no single metric for that for me. Some of it has to do with just the circumstances of my life at the time I encounter the raw material and whether or not the raw material begins to adhere to other things in my notebook. But sometimes it's certainly true that in my notebook I'll notice a little line that says story, and underneath there will be a sort of a lining out of events which I think only are going to be a story and not adhesive with other material. So it's arbitrary. Corby, do I feel energetic enough to even entertain the idea of a novel? Because that usually involves me preparing a year before I ever write anything, and it's for me it's just an undertaking of a different caliber. And stories are easier to write. There are plenty of times when that's all I really have the energy or the time or the interest to do. Other times, sometimes an idea will come to me and I'll think to myself, wow, that's consequential. So I'll just let it linger around. And then, as I say, other material will begin to affix itself to it.
Richard, do you set out to write a novel or does a novel present itself as you're writing?
Authorship means to me I set out to write the novel. I don't back really into anything.
So it's not like a short story becomes something longer. You know what you're setting out to do.
Well, now having said that, I will give the lie to it because when I was living in Dutton, Montana, in Teton County, in 1989, I started making notes for what I thought would be a story that I was going to call Canada. Mm. But I never, for various circumstantial reasons, got around to writing the story. But I did keep on making notes for it. And I made notes for it for 28 years.
Really? Yeah. So you started Canada a
yes.
long time ago.
1989. Over a
amazing.
Little car repair that I rented in Dutton, right up by the side of the grain elevator in the railroad tracks. And when I didn't finish it or didn't really even get started with it, I thought, gee, it's such a good idea. I'm just going to keep on adding in my notebook, in raw material. And so ultimately, I came around to the material, and it was, I thought, good enough to make a novel. So I had originally thought of it as a story, Anna, but it never materialized as a story.
Kind of sat in that material until
it
became something.
That's unusual for me, though. Okay. I think one of my failures as a writer is that I am too interested in controlling everything. I used to want to be a police officer. I was in the Marine Corps, joined the Marines when I was young. And I just like to run things. So I think it's my failure, really, that I don't let things run me enough.
Oh, as a writer, you mean like not necessarily following a storyline, but wanting to control where that storyline is going?
Yes, yeah.
And do you find that then hinders you or has...
Well, it doesn't hinder me enough to keep me from writing a novel. Maybe it should hinder me more. But I don't like to have to come to my work of a morning and see that I have to erase everything I did the day before. So I hammer down on what I'm doing pretty much every day.
There's a preciseness to your work.
Well, that's a nice way of putting it. There's just a kind of over fastidiousness.
So here's something that I just thought of. We interviewed Emily Danforth recently for her book, Miseducation of Cameron Post. And her opening line was, she was out shoplifting with her friends when her parents were killed. And the editor said—
She was shoplifting?
She was out shoplifting in Miles City when her parents were killed. And the editor said, like, oh, you can't start with that. And she said, no, I'm so committed to that. I remember the beginning of Canada, and you know immediately that the parents are bank robbers.
That's right. That's
immediately.
Right.
There's no buildup to it.
Well, I mean, you have a choice, or I had a choice. I can withhold that information and make it be a payoff down the line, or I can divulge it on in paragraph one and make you, the reader, long to know how this happened. So I think it's an embarrassment of riches, really, in a way, to have one or the other available to you.
I'm curious if you brought anything to share, Richard, if you'd like to read something for us.
Sure. My,
I believe you're reading something that's not been published
no,
yet.
No, I just wrote it in September.
So the audience doesn't have a vote at this point as to – you are working on a collection of short stories,
I am,
though,
and
correct?
This is one of them.
Well, I'm excited to hear a portion of it.
Well, this is a story called Diamonds from Ireland, and you're right. I haven't sent it anywhere, it's sold in the third person, which is interesting for me, and it's set on the ferry that goes from Holyhead in Wales across to Dublin. There were three ladies together, he gathered, taking the ferry over from Holyhead, Americans as he was, though the one might have been Canadian, the silver-haired, shorter, laughing one who seemed to be having a better time than the others, though they were all high-spirited, going across to some concert in Dublin, some place on the Docklands, he'd overheard. Others on the ferry were going as well. From where were these women? At one moment, they all three sang together, once, twice, three times a lady, then laughed in a silly way. Whoever recorded that song was who they were excited to see, possibly that night, then be on the late boat back. What was it about them, Americans traveling to Ireland from Wales, on the grand tour, possibly, ladies of a certain age, his mother would have said, why did he think they might be music teachers from the Midwest, three classmates traveling together? Others in the wide-windowed, echoing ferry lounge were more subdued, typical, things on their minds, duties of a day, troubles out ahead. The boat trip, not a novelty to them. Even the children were contained, eating their sour tinned meat sandwiches and warm dills, staring out unfazed at the roiling sea. The whole inside smelled of coffee and disinfectant and crisps and something treacly, rubbish. Once, twice, three times, they retried the song with less brio. No one looked up to notice. He himself was traveling to settle with his solicitors, a dull and lengthy process. Documents needed signatures, witnesses, an oath, nothing that included Barbara, who was gone now, tucked away with the older girl far in the north. He might have flown over from Bristol for the formalities, but the train and the boat, he thought, might make a dismal day less so. There was no hurry. The young woman sitting across on the hard green bench reminded him of Barbara, although Barbara was handsome and this woman not. The Irish look, placidness, the chin slightly incomplete, the rounded, palely lucid cheeks, two plump hands, the blue-eyed stare of grave uninterest. It could make for beauty, great appeal, depth, or it could not. Here was not beauty or appeal, but overall heaviness, the waist, an equator, the legs too large in a too tight skirt that rode up revealingly, still the tribal resemblance, unmistakable. Something, what, reminded him of Ohio, college, recalled a quality in himself that had often led him astray, fall like now, a party in a house in the countryside late at night with drinking. He'd offered to take a similarly unattractive girl back to town, just a ride in. He didn't know her, but believed he experienced some vagrant appeal. At a certain point, they'd pulled off to watch the stars above the river. It had seemed the moment to kiss, to which she'd acquiesced, almost without noticing. Then she'd said, no more of that. Why, he'd ask. Why ruin this, she said. He hadn't thought there was a this to be ruined. There was just now. He hadn't known what to say, but wanted this to turn out at least better than ruin. So he asked her, when precisely, in the night's chain of events, she had realized she would not do more with him than kiss him. What had he done to make that inevitable, if it was? He was being wheedling and ignominious, but he wanted there to be something they'd say if there was going to be nothing else. There was no moment, she'd said, looking into the still spring night in the river. She was from Pennsylvania, just across the river, not very far. He was from Toledo. I'm not attracted to you, she said. I can't even think about it. Can't we go? Later he'd heard she'd married some loutish boy from home. It was understood the boy drank too much. From time to time he would see them at school. He'd wondered if she'd told the tosspot husband about his pitiful attempt, about quizzing her, which, in his mind, was the worst of it, the quizzing after failing. When she saw him, she looked him fiercely in the eye to suggest he'd played some part, some dark part, in how things had turned out badly for her, a crappy chain of bad events. He knew, though, as stupid as he'd been, this could not be true.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have you read any of your books for Audible or any of the books?
Yeah, I've read all of A Multitude of Sins, and it seems that each time that I publish a book, the publisher wants me to record it, but it's really hard to, over a period of days, to record a novel or even a book of stories, and they don't want to pay me enough. And so they'll get some really good actor who's a lot better than I am and pay him or her a lot less.
You and knowing your voice, I sort of laugh to myself when I'm reading a New Yorker short story because I hear your voice in the language. Mm-hmm. It's very clear to me that's your voice and I can hear that.
Yeah. I just need to be there to read all of my books to everybody who ever buys one. I remember one time a guy named Clark Blaze said I was going to give a reading at Lincoln Center. No, it was at the Democratic National Convention. When Clinton was being nominated. And Blaze said to somebody in my hearing, he said, "You really need to hear Ford read his story. It'll never be as good to you again."
I also just remembered, Richard, you are going to be the Stegner Fellow lecture.
Yes.
In the lecture series in Bozeman
this spring. Yes, I am.
I'm delighted.
Well, so am I. I'm thrilled. And I never knew Wallace Stegner, but I've read Wallace Stegner. And indeed, at Columbia, where I'm professor, I taught Wolf Willow last winter, which is a wonderful, stirring, weird, agglomerative book, which makes a whole. Some part of what I'll talk about, I'm sure, in Bozeman is place, not place in fiction so much. I'm, as you can tell from what we said earlier, not terribly interested in that. But I am interested in place on the globe and how we as human beings encounter where we are.
Well, place certainly takes a role in that section you just read, at the descriptions of the Irish hands and the blue eyes, and you just get this sense wash over you that Ireland has a lot to do with who these people are. Tell me where that short story came from or the ideas for what you're working on.
I don't know. I once took that ferry, but I only took it once. And I didn't think when I was taking that ferry from Holyhead to Dublin that it would be something I would write about at the time. But that's typical of me, not that it makes it interesting that it's typical of me, but I sort of put life first. And then later on, after things have happened, I kind of re-encounter them and think, ooh, I could put that in a story. I'd never had thought that I would put it in a story when I was taking that ferry. And those events, as you can well imagine, are not events out of my life. They were totally conjured up by me to have a little, you know, short story. The story is only about 2,700 words long.
So the collection that you're working on of short stories, is it Irish in America, or is that the theme?
They are related stories. I don't want to call them a themed collection just because they vary so much and they really are not variations on a single theme, but it does chiefly have to do in some of its character choices and some of its events with the way in which Irish people have kind of immured themselves into this culture over here in North America, and in some instances become invisible, in some instances become partly visible. That's something I'm interested in. That's my background. My family's Irish, and I didn't know that they were Irish until I was in my 30s. No one even told me that all these people were Irish.
Well, your work, though, is very popular in England and Ireland.
Seems to be.
They understood that, and you didn't know.
Ireland particularly, England somewhat less so. Ireland's very fond of writers, and not just Irish writers, but writers from all over. And they've been kind to me. I've been professor at Trinity for years, and I go to Ireland all the time. And Christina, my wife, and I go and stay there as much as we can. Mm-hmm. Seems like I should write something about it from having
Finished reading Tim Egan's The Irish General.
Yeah.
And
wonderful writer, wonderful guy.
Wonderful writer. And I had forgot how badly the British had treated the Irish.
They haven't.
Well, he was Irish, so he took a stance on that. But the whole story of the Irish in America is so fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Alice McDermott writes about it wonderfully well, those East Coast Irish. They're just larded all through what we think of as American culture.
Richard, when you're working on a short story like this, do you spend time digging through historical data archives, or are you really conjuring up a lot of this through what you know and what your imagination creates?
Well, I think the latter. That little passage that you made reference to about this man who's sitting across from a woman and sort of decides that she's a typical Irish person. I mean, I don't think there is a typical Irish mm-hmm. person. There's not a typical Irish look. There's not a typical Irish attitude. But he concludes that there is, to this woman's, not to her discredit, but probably to her dismay. Mm. But no, I try to do as little of that as I possibly can. I mean, that's why I'm not an English professor in the sure. sense of having a background in academics. I just can't bear to do that.
But you certainly know how to tell a story.
Well, my parents, when I was growing up in Mississippi, were of the persuasion that they should tell me as little as possible about their backgrounds and about their lives, where they grew up in Arkansas and during the Depression. And it caused me, I think, to have to make up the kinds of ligatures and storylines that would make life seem rational and plausible. And I think that's why I do that.
Well, thank you so much, Richard, for being in the studio with us today, sharing a bit of your new work. And we'll have links on our website to what you've been up to lately, and really glad to have you here.
Real pleasure for me to talk to you both. Thanks a
lot. Thank you.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.